This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
This episode is brought to you by Hotels.com. When I went on my last holiday to Cape Town, it was amazing. My friends were there, the weather was phenomenal, and most importantly, the food was fantastic. But one thing I struggled with was finding the right places to stay. You know, all I want is a great bed, a fantastic shower, and breakfast that doesn't end at 8 a.m. I'm on holiday, I'm still sleeping. I also like ease, and the Hotels.com app easily helps me to find a perfect hotel for every trip. Whether you're looking for a family-friendly getaway or a relaxing spa weekend, on the Hotels.com app, you can compare up to 5 hotels side by side. Now, why would you want to do that? So you can see prices, amenities, and star ratings. And best of all, you don't have to switch back and forth between options. See? Ease. So, start planning your next getaway and find your perfect somewhere in the Hotels.com app today.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. There's a new revolution brewing in Eastern Europe. This time it may be capitalism that's in trouble. A dozen years ago, a sense of optimism and promise rose behind the rubble of the Berlin Wall. Eastern Europeans embraced foreign investments and the free market as the road to riches. Now that love affair is over. High unemployment, factory closings, rising inflation, and populist politics are highlighting the harder face of capitalism. Tonight, On Point, Eastern Europe pushes back. We begin with the latest from Wall Street. After another wild day, stocks plummeted after the opening bell and had plunged nearly 200 points by noon. By afternoon, the markets had recovered a bit. By the end of the day, the Dow closed down almost 12 points while the S&P index and NASDAQ returned to positive territory. I spoke with the Washington Post's Wall Street watcher Jerry Knight earlier and asked him what he made of the cheers that went up at the closing bell.
Well, there were cheers of relief, but there was no celebrating on Wall Street today. This was a narrow escape for the stock market. The Dow was down 190 points during the day. It came back to a little bit of a loss, but the trend is still the same. It's been down 4 days in a row, and nobody sees any fundamental change. Investors have no real reasons to buy stocks yet, and there are a lot of things that are scaring them away from the market.
So where's the floor? Is there a floor?
Well, that's the big question. If I could guess that, I'd be rich, and we all would be, I think, but because no one sees quite where the bottom is. The traditional view on Wall Street is that markets end their downturns with a big sell-off, one big blast day.
And that's it.
And that's kind of what it takes. It takes the day when what they call capitulation, when everybody throws in the towel, and we haven't quite seen that.
The puke point, I've heard that described as.
That's a good line.
But with this drumbeat of revelations coming out day after day, week after week, it's hard to find that complete capitulation. There's always a new story. There was even today.
That's right. There is another piece of dirty linen every day. Today, it was a company that's really very respectable, Bristol-Myers Squibb, one of the big names in pharmaceuticals. They are disclosing that the Securities and Exchange Commission is investigating their accounting. You know, what's new? This time, it turns out that Bristol-Myers Squibb, to make its sales look good, just shipped a lot of products to its wholesalers at the end of the year. They didn't even care whether they paid for them or not. They wanted to get them out of the warehouses so they could claim that they were sales. And now the SEC says, wait a minute, that's not right. And we're going to have another accounting scandal.
And then the dynamic of the stock losses starting to feed on themselves, concern about General Motors being able to cover its pension plans. Why are people concerned about that?
This feedback loop is what really scares people, Tom, and we see it today with General Motors. What happened was that an analyst said he's going to downgrade General Motors stock because the company needs to put more money into its pension plan. And why does it need to put more money into its pension plan? Because the pension plan has been losing money in the stock market. We've got a loop going here, and that's very scary to people. And there are other loops like this. One of the things we see going on now is that mutual funds are selling some of their big blue chip stocks. They are getting redemption calls from investors. When you sell your mutual fund shares, they have to sell some stock. And what they sell are the big names, the big profitable stocks, because they're easy to get rid of, and that sends them down.
What's the chatter around the edges here? Are big investors and small investors both looking for a way out? Or is one more likely to run than the other? What's the wise guy chatter at this point?
Well, a friend of mine who's a money manager today said he's been looking for someone to manage about $50 million. And a lot of the managers he talked to said they're not sure that it's time to get back into the market yet. They think that maybe stocks are still overpriced. When you hear that from pros, from the kinds of people who make $50 million decisions, you know that it's not just the small investors who are worried. It's the guys with big money.
And what kind of statistics or indicators are people looking at as potentially turning something around? I mean, do price-earnings ratios constitute a final firewall? If they get way back down in line with historical numbers, would that be a point that people say, well, I mean, that would take a lot of falling still, but would that be a bottom?
I think that's one of the factors they're looking at. The folks who think stocks are overpriced believe that price-earnings ratios of many shares are still too high by historical standards, so they need to come down. The big if here, of course, is earnings, and in the next 2 or 3 weeks, we'll be seeing the second quarter earnings from the big corporations. Those numbers are going to determine what happens on Wall Street really for the rest of the summer. They are the hard facts about corporate profits that will drive stock prices through until September.
Of course, Jerry Knight, someone is buying here because with all the nervousness now out there, there's a ton of selling. And in spite of that, the Dow ended up 11 or 12 points today.
Well, we saw that today. You know, the Dow stocks have been down, some of them, 10 or 12% in the last 3 or 4 days. That's an opportunity for some investors. So they stepped in today. They turned the market around. But the consensus seems to be that there are not enough people who have that much confidence in the market to stop this slide immediately.
Is there much talk about the leadership issue, Jerry? Both President Bush and Vice President Cheney are grappling with their own kind of mini hassles and scandals out of history at the moment in Harkin Energy and Halliburton. We don't know what those will amount to, but is there a sense that they are handicapped in their effort to lead the country out of this scandal phase?
I think that's very much a concern. Wall Street is looking to Washington to clean up this market, to restore faith in corporate America. And just one day after President Bush gives a speech on cleaning up the market, he's himself caught up in one of these issues. The president said he disapproves of companies who give loans to insiders, and it turns out he got 2 insider loans. That hurts his credibility, and then we have this whole bigger issue with Halliburton Corporation, which seems to have inflated its earnings while Vice President Cheney was at the helm. And their credibility is enormously damaged by this. On top of that, of course, we've got the problem of the Securities and Exchange Commission Chairman Harvey Pitt. Even the Republicans want him out because they think he's too close to the accountants. All these credibility issues make investors very nervous.
Jerry, how's your 401k?
My 401k is not doing as well as I'd like, and I took a lot of money out of the stock market earlier this year.
Well, hang in there. Jerry Knight, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks, Tom.
Jerry Knight is business reporter for The Washington Post. He spoke with me earlier today from Washington, D.C. My mistake there in the interview, the Dow was down 11.97% today. We're talking tonight about Eastern Europe's new fury with free markets and the privatization that has dismantled the old world of socialism. Recently, Romanian workers who said they could do a better job barred the owners of an American-owned can factory from setting foot in the facility. In Slovakia, 5,000 state railway workers stormed the capital last year to stop the railroad's privatization. In Poland, the state is stepping back in to buy factories and save them from closing down. A few years ago, Eastern Europe's pushback might have been shrugged off as inevitable resistance to the painful side of privatization. Today, with Western-style capitalism taking heat even on Wall Street, Eastern Europe's brewing rebellion looms a bit larger. Does anyone, any region, have the option of opting out of the global market today? What do you make of the pushback in Eastern Europe? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Lakeside, Michigan, is Elizabeth Williamson, a Warsaw-based reporter for The Wall Street Journal. Good evening and welcome, Elizabeth Williamson.
Thanks, Tom.
Thanks for being with us. And joining us from the studios of Vermont Public Radio is On Point News analyst Jack Beattie, a senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly magazine. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom.
Elizabeth, you have reported quite compellingly of examples of very tough resistance to the free market way recently. Are these isolated events or signs of a real backlash?
Well, these things tend to be cyclical, Tom, in nature, and this one seems to be particularly tied to these countries joining the European Union in 2004. And it's particularly worrying this time. They tend to go up and down with economic hardship in the region. This time they're particularly worrying because they could hog-tie these countries in their drive towards European Union, and that would severely hamper the region's economy.
You've written that across Eastern Europe, a workers' revolt has become a threat. What is it about joining the EU that workers and others see as threatening?
Basically, more pain. What's happened in the last 10 years in these countries has been a real economic miracle, but it hasn't come without cost. So what's happened is that foreign investors have come in, they've bought up old state plants, they've created greenfield sites or developed greenfield sites into new factories. But along with all of that has come a lot of restructuring. And what workers have said is that that boils down for them into job cuts. So 10 years on, they're seeing winners and losers, and they wonder if European Union will mean more pain for them and ultimately a loss in the world marketplace.
The first decade of free market experimentation has gone fairly well for a lot of these countries, has it not? I mean, didn't the first 10 years turn out pretty well?
Yeah, it did create a lot of winners, among them the Czech Republic, Hungary, Poland, the Baltic states. But once again, you know, those, I think what workers are seeing is that it's also created inequities. Privatization in particular has created inequities. And what the workers are feeling is the sort of, you know, that everybody is no longer equal in their poverty, but rather that there are winners and losers in a free marketplace. And they often see, and this is a perception problem, they often see themselves as the losers.
Elizabeth, give us a tangible sense of how this can play out. You've written about a can factory in Tecuci, Romania, owned by or largely owned at this point by F&P Holding of Temple, Pennsylvania, an American company. Give us just the bare bones, the kind of hair-raising details of how hard it became for that American company to manage its can factory in Romania.
Okay, that company came in. It's a small holding company. Some Americans might know them as Giorgio Foods. They've been around since 1928. They have in the last 10 years created a significant part of their profits in Eastern Europe because it was a wide open place and they create packaging. They came into Poland in 1989. They were one of the first foreign investors in. They bought an old defunct state-run can factory there. So they made a success out of that. They did very, very well. So then they went into Romania in 1997, and they decided that they would try and create the same thing, and they would develop packaging for the Balkans and for the Middle East from that base. Things went along pretty well for a couple of years. They had a couple managers. Then they started noticing that two of their top managers in the company weren't managing the books very well. There were losses. There were outstanding invoices. They didn't seem to be running a tight ship in the accounting department. So they set them up to try and get them to turn things around and to run a little bit more disciplined operation.
And the response was not exactly lovely.
Exactly. Yeah, they gave them 2 years to try and put the company back into the black. They were reporting that it was making a small profit, but in fact, it was running in the red. So they went back. They met with them. This was their Polish subsidiary. They met with them in Poland. These were F&P's representatives. They told them 2 years to turn it around. They went back. They were able to stir up a sort of simmering resentment toward the investors within the plant.
And take us to the nadir of this relationship and what we see there.
I think that the real peak came about this time last year, where they had a shareholders meeting in which workers and small investors holding less than 1% of the shares managed to exclude the investors using a technicality in the Romanian law, managed to exclude the investors entirely from voting in a shareholders meeting. They voted the two managers who were about to be fired back in, And they basically took control of the plant. And they
all
physically barred the investors.
That's right, physically barring, and all this in the context of bodyguards and allegations of people being beaten up and a lot of physical intimidation around the edges.
Yeah, it was quite a colorful situation in which they employed off-duty police as security guards to prevent the investors from coming in. There were a couple physical scuffles.
It got pretty rough. Jack Beatty, when you hear this, can you imagine what's going on in the minds of Eastern European workers trying to come to terms with the rougher patches of capitalism?
Yeah, I mean, their economic psychology was formed by years of socialism where, as Elizabeth said, they were equal in their poverty. But it was also a predictable poverty. They had a job. It was going to last. They didn't make anything. It was make work, much of it. But at least there was continuity and stability. But now there's the moral shock. You know, they're right there with the market. And capitalism, market capitalism, is not a natural but a historical formation. It's something that happened in history. It happened here in about the 1830s, and many of these responses where people went from being independent people on the land to being wage laborers, you could run some of this back in the 1830s and see very much the same thing, where people suddenly faced the fact that there was this thing, the market, and they had to answer to it. They hadn't before.
It takes some getting used to. Eastern Europe is having a little hiccup with that right now. We're talking about Eastern Europe perhaps in a workers' revolt over privatization, over capitalism. Does anyone, any region, have the option of opting out of the global market today? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about Eastern Europe in a workers' revolt over privatization, over capitalism. What do you think? Are you sympathetic to the unhappy workers of Eastern Europe, or should they just get with the program? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We've been talking with Elizabeth Williamson. She's a Warsaw-based reporter for the Wall Street Journal. I want to welcome into our conversation now John Nellis. He's a senior fellow at the Center for Global Development in Washington, D.C. Good evening and welcome, John Nellis.
Good evening.
John, you've heard some of Elizabeth's report and probably read as well. She's talking about a decade of economic reforms in Eastern Europe that gave workers a taste of a better life, but a bellyful, as she writes, of the free market's downside to layoffs, production targets, profitability goals, and when they do run into unemployment, not many benefits. Is this a serious pushback at this point? Is this just one more in a cyclical kind of coming to terms with capitalism? How do you interpret what's going on?
Mr. Ashbrook, listen, when I was in Moscow in 1998, I met this wise old Russian economist who said the following. He said, everything the communists told us about socialism was a complete and utter lie. But unfortunately, everything they said about capitalism turns out to be true.
those dirty dogs.
And that was the tough part of the situation for them. They've paid a lot of pain. They've suffered a lot of pain. They've paid a very high price. And the social and economic price they've paid is higher than most people thought it would be. It's higher than many politicians said it would be. And the period of the pain has lasted longer than politicians said it would last at the outset. Unemployment in all of these countries, in all of the transition countries, unemployment is higher today than it was in 1991.
18% in Poland recently.
Yeah, it's tough. And income inequality has worsened dramatically across the region. Not in some countries, like the Czech Republic, not so bad. In other countries like Russia and parts of the former Soviet Union, really seriously. Now, one can argue that maybe this is a necessary preparation for growth. One can argue that you can't make an omelet without breaking eggs. But let's face it, there's a lot of eggs that have been broken.
And at this point, these are democratic countries by and large. So governments can't just say, yes, sir, yes, ma'am, to the IMF, impose whatever, and expect to be reelected.
Now, this is a tough situation for them. We've only had one case, as far as I know, we've only had one case in the transition region in which a free election has resulted in return of kind of antediluvian communists, and that's in Moldova. But in most other places, the reform has lasted. It's held in spite of all the economic pain they're suffering. The regimes that have been elected, the electorates have turned more towards reformers, towards at least socialists, not outright communists. The democratic process is still working and working well.
But we hear politicians, populist politicians now, angrily saying, okay, socialism wasn't great, but capitalism, as you say, all the bad stuff was true.
Yeah.
We want a third way. Is there such a thing? We've read that history has ended. Francis Fukuyama tells us it's over. This is the way. Is Eastern Europe going to insist on trying to find some middle ground? Is it there?
No, I don't think they will. They mentioned that the possibility of a third way, a third route, way back in Václav Klaus in the Czech Republic said that the third way is the shortest route to the third world. His argument there was that this kind of mixed economy stuff, the intervention in the marketplace, but still with a capitalist orientation, that it just didn't work.
Elizabeth Williamson, explain to us why that doesn't work. What happens, as you and others have reported, governments are now looking at actually renationalizing. In Poland, they're have announced they'll renationalize shipyards. When the government tries to get back in and rebuffer the economy, what happens? What's the consequence?
Basically, they run out of cash even faster than they would have had they not done that. And that was the case in the Szczecin shipyard about a month ago, in which the government stepped in. We have in Poland a leftist government composed of former communists. They are sort of seeking what probably you could term something between a third way and a back way.
Mm-hmm.
And they stepped in and tried to renationalize the shipyard, but unfortunately they did that before realizing how heavily indebted the shipyard was. So they found that once they started to negotiate with the shipyard's creditors, who were all, mind you, private lenders, they couldn't get them to forgive 80% of the debts, which is what they wanted. So they had to tell a yard full of shouting workers, and they had to sort of wipe literally egg off their faces as they explained that the shipyard was in fact bankrupt.
Wasn't that bankrupt? So Eastern Europe is taking a little bit of a step back here. Ian Fisher writes in the Times about this wonderful graffiti in Poland, free market, enslaved people. But how long can that last? Listeners, is Eastern Europe just not ready to deal with the rough spots of capitalism? Will it ever be? Must it be? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. John Nellis, how long can Eastern Europe afford to try and duck the pain? What bill comes due as they, play with the third way idea?
Well, the bill could be acute, but I think I know. One has to realize that there's still some bright spots, that the old state enterprises and those enterprises that have been kept back in the hands of the state, they are still failing. They're doing poorly. The privatized enterprises are not doing as well as we hoped. But there is a bright spot, and that's in what one might call the new startups, the greenfield stuff.
Mm-hmm.
The new enterprises that came out of entities which were never privatized, they turn out to be doing pretty well.
Not the
big old dinosaurs.
Mm-hmm.
That stuff turns out to be too hard to turn around. But if you can get some of the storefronts and some of the assets from those old dinosaurs and turn it over to small and medium enterprises which are entrepreneurial, you can get good growth. And we've seen a lot of that around the region, and that's what's keeping these places alive.
Elizabeth Williamson, describe for us what you've seen in the workers' eyes and in what they've said to you about the struggle to move from, a born and bred socialist outlook on the world to a player in a free market society who has to roll with the punches. What is the internal struggle like to come to terms with that?
Sure, Tom. First, I wanted to address one other point that John made just
Please.
Now.
Mm-hmm.
When he talked about, this whole idea of what I'm noticing that is rather worrying is that you have labor unions who were really at the forefront of the fall of communism, particularly in Poland, where you had the Solidarity movement.
Lech Walesa standing high and...
Exactly. And that's why this Szczecin shipyard image is so powerful, because you have, a worker saying, well, yeah, we fought to throw off the whole system, but then you have the same group sort of embracing a leftist government and trying to see what they'll be able to do for them. There, when you talk about, John was mentioning these sort of vibrant mid-sized businesses and the sort of startups and things. The thing that's particularly worrying is that you have workers who say, You know, we're going to actually stand in the way, labor unions stand in the way of changes in the labor code that will allow entrepreneurs to flourish, that will allow startups to grow, because we're very nervous about how that's going to affect our livelihoods. We really need our benefits and perks, and we fought hard for those.
I mean, they're saying we want to be in the context of a big old dinosaur. We're worried about these smaller, quicker, less regulated companies.
Yeah, exactly. They're worrying about the changes that those companies, which are supplying the bulk of Poland's economy at this point, they're worrying about the changes that those companies are pushing for in order to ensure their growth.
Jack Beatty, here's a conundrum. This is not Bolsheviks. These are labor unionists having cold feet about the prescription that they're told will take them headed, as Elizabeth Williamson says, you know, actively kind of hanging on to the dinosaur environment.
Yeah, it's pretty hard to sacrifice your job for the principle of, you know, market capitalism.
And yet millions of Americans do it every day.
Right, but I'm saying we have kind of gotten used to it and taken it as our mm-hmm. medicine. I disagree with John Nellis. I think the struggle in this century is going to be to try to find a third way. I think that we have never had a regime of free trade in the history of the world. We're experimenting with it now with all kinds of qualifications. And in the end, of course, society has to come before the economy. And I think that is going to – I think the struggle between society, which needs more equality, which needs stability, and economy, which needs dynamism and liberty, I think that struggle is going to define much of the next century. And I just do not see this triumphalist notion that there's only one way. Because if there is only one way, then there's a race to the bottom. If there is only one way, then there is no possibility of politics intervening in markets and saying, no, there are human priorities first, and we're all going to do this together. So I don't agree with that.
Well, as you know, a lot of American politicians embrace the markets over politics. Let's put it to our listeners. Eastern Europeans
not today.
Eastern Europeans are talking about a third way between capitalism and socialism. Is that just a dream, or is there a third way? We're at 1-800-423-8255. DeBayu is on the line. Welcome, DeBayu. You're on the air.
Okay. My comment was that actually, if you compare between different countries in Europe, in Eastern Europe, the most successful one were the ones that actually are not longer run by left parties' governments.
Mm-hmm.
The one that actually have left parties in power, like Romania, like Russia, and recently Hungary and Poland, who switched back to the left parties, are lower in standings, let's say, than Czech Republic or Slovenia or the Baltic countries.
Dubai, where are you from?
I'm from Romania, and I'm living right now in Boston.
And you see a left-leaning government there being a problem for Romania's economic development?
Absolutely. The assets of the economy are still in the government property. We speak about privatization, but it's only about 10 or 20% of the national wealth.
Dubayu, thank you for that observation. Let me put it to John Nellis. John, do you agree that the governments who have been more aggressive in privatizing have made more progress and have happier workers at this point?
Yes and no. They have made more progress, and they probably have unhappier workers. That's the dilemma. Look, you take a place like Estonia. Estonia is a small country, formerly part of the Soviet Union. They privatized right. They did it right. And by right, I mean they went out and they found real new owners. They didn't just hand away stuff to vouchers and then let the managers take over. They got themselves real strategic owners who knew how to access foreign markets and foreign capital. Mm-hmm. And they find themselves with a fairly high growth rate. They find themselves with a fairly low rate of unemployment. They find themselves with probably one of the best outcomes of all the transition economies. And it's a question of good policy. I simply don't think that there is much of a third way. I think one can certainly recognize that the private sector is in these countries not to do good. They're there to do well.
Mm-hmm.
And there certainly is an absolute necessity for governments to play the role of setting up guidelines and guiding posts so that there is a mutually beneficial situation between private investment and social need. I don't think that's disputable. What is disputable is that there's
some alternative mechanism out there which will ignore the fundamental rules of the marketplace and still allow you to have growth.
Looks like
distribution's great, but you got to have something to distribute first.
Looks like pie in the sky to you. Let's get a first-hand report from a businessman who has gone with the free market path and has found some success there. We're joined now from Riga, Latvia, at an ungodly hour, and we thank him for joining us, by Alexei Shchenin. Good evening and welcome, Mr. Shchenin.
Hi, nice to listen to you.
It's great to have you. You started a four-page free newspaper in 1991. You turned it into a business in 94. You've now got a publishing company in Riga, 300 employees, the first Latvian publishing house. No foreign investment, no loans. It sounds like the free market has worked for you. Why do we see, from your perspective, what worked for you, and why isn't everybody as happy and successful as you appear to be?
Thank you for your question. I think, used the obstacles which opened 10 or 12 years ago, and it was absolutely new for us. Nobody teach us how to use the free market. Now we have the result which you mentioned about us, yeah, and exactly, yeah, with no loans, yeah, no credits, yeah. Mm-hmm. No, that's it.
Do you think that workers in Eastern Europe are resisting now or pushing back in a way that may have serious consequences for the political and economic life of Eastern Europe? Is this a real revolt against capitalism at this point, or not?
You see, I cannot take responsibility about all Eastern Europe. More, I cannot take responsibility about all the Latvia. But just speaking about, for example, my company, with 300 employees, I always am saying to I'm talking to my labor, and not bosses, but people who would like to establish trade unions. Yeah?
Yes. Yeah.
Always I say to him, guys, please, if you will prove to me that you will do more to employee than I'm doing now, if you can put them more than I'm giving to them with vacation, with any special money, if you somebody born in your family, or I'm sorry, somebody die in your family, if you are have responsibility for them, please. If not, please ask my employee who is better, me and company, or your trade union.
Alexei Shchenin, are you confident, are you optimistic that free markets, that capitalism, will ultimately take full hold and prosper in Latvia?
Oh, wow. So. From one side, of course, because we see the results, and we see how we see new faces of our cities, of our country. It's exactly. But if you are asking to me, like an owner of a medium business, of course, I need to say that we have a few serious misgivings before we will be the part of United Europe.
Mm-hmm.
Because it will be very difficult to compete with brand names. To compete, with McDonald's. I'm sorry. just to compete.
Well, and maybe even you, the publishing monsters. We thank you very much for joining us tonight from Riga. Thank you very much, Alexei Shchenin.
Thank you for your question.
Elizabeth Williamson, there's one of your greenfield companies, not a dinosaur taken over, and even he is saying he is so-so in his confidence about adoption of the free market ultimately.
Yeah, I mean, I guess you could argue that point. I think that ultimately, I'm with John on this one. I think that ultimately, of course, capitalism and the free market will prevail. But I think it's proving much, much more bumpy than anyone thought. And it could mean that the schedule that everybody hoped for, meaning that, you know, you'll have 10 new countries in the European Union in 2004, is not going to happen. And who the laggards are will really determine the future of the process. So if, for example, you have a problem with Poland getting in, you could end up with real trouble. If you have a few, you know, Romania and Bulgaria, they won't join until later this decade. So who holds up the process, how big they are, and what that means for the rest is really going to determine.
That's the question. We're talking about Eastern Europe pushing back against the free markets. What do you think? Are you sympathetic to the unhappy workers of Eastern Europe, or should they just get with the program? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about Eastern Europe pushing back against free markets and capitalism after 10-year love affair, or at least an upswing in Eastern Europe and an embrace of the experiment. There is now a lot of worker resistance. What do you think? Eastern Europeans talk about a third way between capitalism and socialism. Is that just a dream? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined tonight by Elizabeth Williamson. She's a Warsaw-based reporter for the Wall Street Journal, and by John Nellis, senior fellow at the Center for Global Development based in Washington, D.C., and right now by Andrea. Welcome, Andrea. You're on the air.
Hello. Hello.
Hi.
Yeah, my observation, I lived in Poland for a while back in 25, 30 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And my observation is that then the average man in the street was not so much pro-capitalism as anti-Russian, that anti-Soviet, that they wanted to throw off the Soviet yoke. And they didn't really talk about embracing capitalism. They talked about getting rid of the Russians.
Get out from under the thumb of the bear.
Yes, and I actually knew some socialist Poles who were pleased with socialism they didn't think it was perfect, but they believed in socialism as an ideology.
But they got capitalism anyway. Do you think do they have the psychology, in your experience, to ultimately make it work and stick with it, even when it's not easy?
So many people were, a whole generation was inculcated into that socialist mindset of having the government take care of you, that it is really hard for them. And it's like they spent a generation learning that, and now they're going to need to spend another generation unlearning it. It's going to be a long haul, I'm afraid.
Andrea, thank you for your call. John Nellis, if it takes another generation, as Elizabeth Williams says, it's the timetable that may be in question here. If it takes another generation, what are the implications of that for political stability, for economic progress in Eastern Europe?
Well, it could be troubling. I think you already see that in the recent elections, for example, in the Czech Republic, the old line and fairly unreconstructed communists got about 20% of the vote, and that's pretty alarming for a lot of the free market-oriented parties in that country. As I said before, Moldova has actually had a return to unreconstructed communist government. But fortunately, and in my view, fortunately at least, and I think in the view of many, that this kind of turn back to the past has been relatively minor.
Mm-hmm.
But it could resurface, and if that should happen, I think what you would have is not simply a politics of social democracy, as one sees in Western Europe, but something new and potentially troubling.
We may debate here whether or not there is any option to the free market way. But, of course, ultimately it'll be politicians elected in Eastern Europe who decide which way they want to go, I guess.
Well, that's an excellent statement, because one of the things I would like to make clear is that frequently in the West there is this notion that Western economists and Western institutions and Western governments have been calling the shots about how this process will unfold. And in point of fact, it's their process to unfold, and it's their process to win or lose. And much of what happens there is going to be determined by internal political systems and situations in those countries, and the external world will have a marginal effect.
Elizabeth Williamson, is it possible? I mean, I hear both you and John saying, no, they're ultimately going to end up in this camp. But what if they simply resist it through decades and decades of training and habit? What if they say, no, we just won't go down that road? Call us mulish or call us, stuck in habits. We won't do it. Does that way simply lead to punishment? Or is there no way to break through to some different balance?
Well, I'll use an example from Moldova because we're talking about that a little bit about the recidivist communists who've come to power there. I was just there not long ago, and there's a really sort of interesting thing that points to the fact that if people don't go down that road, in a sense, that road will kind of go down them, meaning that there's a momentum to this process, even in a country like Moldova, which is Europe's poorest, desperately impoverished and relying on what it grows for survival. There you have the communist government talking about it's unusual in that they've managed to privatize all their farmland. With U.S. help, there's been a program there that's been very successful and amazingly so, especially for a former Soviet Union country. But you have the government giving these reports on how output has grown 4% on these privatized farms, et cetera, and then turning around and saying, but if we rebuilt the collectives, we might have more. You know,
it's hard to let go.
Yeah, but at the other, on the other hand, you know, you have that undisputable success. And at some point, I think everybody's hoping for this, and I think it will eventually happen. You will have a critical mass of people who say, listen, it worked for us, like our Latvian businessmen. Hey, it worked for me.
Let's get over it. Let's go.
Right.
Jim is calling from Watertown, Wisconsin. Welcome, Jim. You're on the air.
I have a little different perspective.
Great.
I think the workers in Europe sense that, as I understand it, in the next 20 years there's going to be about zero population increase versus maybe 20% in the United States. Workers here have a sense of upward mobility. And there, I think they have a feeling we're stuck here. So we have to make the best of whatever it is. And I think they have a hopelessness.
Jim, you're saying they're stuck there because of what?
Because there is a lack of upward mobility in the United States. In the next 20 years, I believe we're expecting a 20% increase in population. Every major European country in the next 20 years is projecting a static population increase. So workers, I think, feel stuck. In the United States, they have an upward mobility sense.
Jim, thanks for the observation. John Nellis, what about the demographic background here? Is there something about the population profile that you see prodding Eastern Europeans into their attitude?
Well, I'm not sure the figures the gentleman cited, but I can certainly say that what you have is an impending problem in all of Europe, not only Eastern Europe, but Western Europe, in which relatively stable population means that there's increasing difficulties in paying the generous pensions that they've allotted to themselves, so that with fewer and fewer workers coming into the stream, there's fewer and fewer people able to pay for the pensions. And that is a huge problem, but I'm not quite sure how that relates to what the gentleman said.
Our time is running down. John Nellis, I want to thank you for joining us tonight for this conversation.
Hey, my pleasure.
John Nellis is senior fellow at the Center for Global Development based in Washington, D.C., and Elizabeth Williamson on vacation and generously joining us from Lakeside, Michigan. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
Elizabeth Williamson is a Warsaw-based reporter for the Wall Street Journal. Jack, I've saved a minute to hear you out now. You're going to stand up for that third way. What are your thoughts after what we've heard here?
I guess what I'm saying is I think there's a historical dynamic at work, and it is the dynamic, really, that Joseph Stiglitz, who's a former IMF economist, points to in his recent book, Globalization and Its Discontents. Mm-hmm. And it's the tension, the effort to reconcile globalization with democracy. And we've just heard test cases how democracy is being put at risk because of the excesses of the market, the shock of the market. Now, do we value the market over democracy? No. If this miscarries, if there is no even struggle for a third way, if it's just simply all mech world, I fear what Ben Barber calls jihad. The other principle, the principle of nihilism, the principle of, you know, just break out of it, the principle we see in the Muslim world.
But Elizabeth Williamson says, hang in there, you'll begin to see the benefits, and when you do, you'll be happy you're part of it.
Well, they're in a struggle, and historical struggles take a long time, and they're not just simply, history is not over.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation online. Go to onpointradio.org and click on forums. In a moment, John McCain speaks out on corporate scandal. This is On Point. He describes himself as a Roosevelt Republican, so it's no surprise that Senator John McCain has a lot to say about corporate governance. Speaking out at the National Press Club today, the former presidential candidate laid out his vision for dealing with the accounting scandals that have rocked the stock market. In response to President Bush's speech earlier in the week, McCain said, "Stronger sanctions alone will not be enough to deter new incidents of corporate misconduct. Neither will pleas for character building in corporate suites." Here are some excerpts from Senator McCain's speech.
We're the greatest nation in history because we trust in freedom. We trust that a people who are free to act in their own self-interest will perceive their self-interest in an enlightened way and use their wealth and power to create a civilization in which all people can share in the opportunities and responsibilities of freedom. Threats to our greatness come not just from foreign enemies and alien ideologies that hold our ideals in contempt. They also come from among those few among us who perceive their self-interest as separate from the interests of our society, who in their selfish pursuits abjure the values of honesty, fairness, and patriotism, and threaten to damage the very trust that makes freedom work. I am a supporter of the free enterprise system to the marrow of my bones. I marvel at the American entrepreneurial genius and at the innovation of corporations that effectively harness that genius to create greater prosperity for more and more people. As Teddy Roosevelt said almost a century ago, we draw the line against misconduct, not against wealth. The capitalist who alone or in conjunction with his fellows performs some great industrial feat by which he wins money is a well-doer, not a wrongdoer, provided he works in the proper and legitimate lines. During my years in Congress, I have opposed unnecessary regulation of business activity, mindful that the heavy hand of government can discourage innovation and wealth creation. But the current threat to our prosperity comes not from overregulation. The culprits are corporate executives who exploited regulatory loopholes and diffident oversight from boards of directors, analysts, auditors, and government to enrich themselves at the expense of their company's health and the millions of investors who entrusted to those new malefactors of great wealth their American dream of a college education for their children, secure employment, and a comfortable retirement for themselves. Over the past 10 years, the system of check and balances that protect the investor has seriously deteriorated. It must be restored if we are to restore the public's confidence in our financial markets and reinvigorate their faith that there is room in our markets for their dreams as well as the ambitions of executives who profit so handsomely from them. The first principle of free markets, transparency and trust, have been the first victims of crony capitalism, evidenced most dramatically in the scandals involving Enron, Arthur Andersen, Global Crossing, WorldCom, Tyco, and others. Some will counsel this crisis in corporate governance is not so grave that it requires decisive government intervention. I disagree. What is at risk in this series of unfolding corporate scandals is the trust that investors, employees, and all Americans have in our markets and, by extension, in the country's future. To love the free market is to loathe the scandalous behavior of those who have betrayed the values of transparency, trust, contract and faith that lie at the heart of a healthy and prosperous free enterprise system and the patriotism that sustains an aspiring and confident free society.
Senator John McCain speaking today at the National Press Club in Washington. Jack Beatty, we can hear there a prominent Washington politician struggling for a new kind of balance, certainly, than we had in the 90s between government and the markets, between regulation and non-regulation.
Yes, and this is a free market Republican. This isn't a liberal Democrat. But, you know, I wonder if the president had delivered this speech with its decisive diagnoses of the problem, whether the stock market would have responded better than it did to his. And, you know, this is a philosophical speech. He contrasts enlightened self-interest with what he calls that reckless greed that threatens our prosperity. And, of course, Tocqueville saw enlightened self-interest as the absolute key to America. Tocqueville wrote, "Each American knows when to sacrifice some of his private interest to save the rest." McCain shows how we got away from that, and he suggests the reason isn't that we were bad people, but because the system was bad. There were all sorts of conflict of interest built into it, and the way to deal with it is not to ask people to change their characters, but to change the system. His diagnosis of the problem as against the president's, well, I just felt like this is the way a man looks at a real problem, and give it, rather than a sort of fictive version of it that I think the president couldn't quite bring himself to say.
It's a very un-Reagan-like line, saying the real threat is from those who see their self-interest as separate from the general good.
Yeah, as separate from society. And, of course, that's exactly what we've been seeing through all this stuff. And people who just, you know, myrmidons of greed, who just see themselves as apart from and, in fact, sort of predators on society. This is a great speech, and I hope lots of people get a chance to read it in the newspaper.
Read all about it tomorrow, but you heard it here tonight. Jack, thanks for being with us this hour.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is WB.